This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we get the latest on government documents marked classified, found in both an office space used by President Biden as well as his private residence in Delaware after his term as vice president. Now it's this week's edition of Food Friday. To set us up, here's a familiar voice.
Everyone loves a delicious, well-made salad. Cold, crisp leaves of any kind of lettuce dressed with homemade vinaigrette is a perfect lunch.
Martha Stewart there. Our next guest has a close connection with salads, lunch, and Martha Stewart as a cook in her test kitchen and on her TV shows for over 10 years. In her new cookbook, she has tons of recipes and advice to help us become salad all-stars. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you spice up your salad? Have you decided to try to eat maybe healthier, maybe more salads in this new year? Are you like me and salads are the most boring thing that you make in the kitchen? What questions do you have about how to get better at it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jess Damick is a food stylist and cookbook author. Her new book is called Salad Freak, Recipes to Feed a Healthy Obsession. Jess, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
How did you become a salad freak?
You know, I've always really loved salads. And I think, you know, I've been in the food industry for over a decade. I went to culinary school. And anytime anyone asked me, what's your favorite thing to cook? And I said, salads. Everyone was really surprised and I think kind of disappointed. But they're truly like the thing I love to eat and the thing I love to make. So I'm happy to see that there are a lot of other salad freaks out there, too.
Well, I feel very seen reading your book. You say at one point, you know, the reason a lot of us make boring salads, as I do, is we think of the salad as an afterthought. We put in all this effort working on the stovetop or in the oven or whatever and like, oh, I want a salad too. I'll throw some greens in a bowl and some cut up some vegetables and put out a jar of dressing or something like that. Make the case that we can give the salad a little more love.
Yeah. You know, it's funny now that I've been in salad mode for such a long time. It's hard for me to cook any other way. I kind of feel like it's like a cheating because it really is like an all-in-one meal. You have a ton of veggies, you have your protein, and you can even have a grain mixed in. You know everything's going to taste really good together. You get a great mix of texture and color, and you don't have to think about all the other components that you need to have on the side.
One thing that made my salads better definitely was when I finally caved and got a salad spinner, which is not like an expensive piece of equipment, but nothing kills a salad with greens in it. Not all your salads have greens, but nothing kills a salad with greens, I think, than soggy greens, right?
It's true. Soggy greens, dirty greens is even worse.
Oh, yeah.
Especially if you're going out to the farmer's market or your garden and getting greens, you know, nothing's worse than like spending all of this time preparing a salad and then taking that first bite and being like, that is definitely something I learned working with Martha. It's very important to clean and dry your salad greens.
And you have a technique using that salad spinner. It's a little, I usually just, you know, use the, you know, mesh part as a colander, rinse it off, and then drop it in there. You actually give the greens a bath in there. If I'm reading it right, what do you do?
Yeah, I like to fill up the salad spinner. I put my greens in there and then sort of just gently move my hand around in there. And that really helps any dirt or sand or whatever is on there, little inchworms, bugs. You can, all that stuff is going to come off really, really well. Sometimes if things are super dirty, I empty out the water and do it a second time. And then empty out the water and give it a really good spin. And then your leaves are super clean and really dry and totally ready for a salad. Sometimes I like to do that as soon as I get home from the market as well, because I find if I do it right away and then have lettuce greens that are ready to go, I'm much more likely to use up that lettuce very quickly instead of letting it sort of like get sad in the back of the refrigerator.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Jess Damick. Her new cookbook is called Salad Freak, Recipes to Feed a Healthy Obsession. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite kind of salad, your favorite ingredient to put on a salad? Maybe something people wouldn't expect to see there. Or do you need some inspiration? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can find some recipes from our guest at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll get into a couple of those recipes in a minute. But just, you know, it's the middle of winter here. We're talking about salads. A lot of people might think salad's a summer food. Winter, we want warm, hearty stuff. You say no. Make the case for the salad as a great winter food.
Yeah, it was really surprising while I was writing the book and everything was coming together. You know, I realized, wow, I actually love a lot of the ingredients that are available during the winter. I'm in Los Angeles, so I'm like very spoiled. And right now I'm surrounded by incredible citrus. And that's something I really, really love adding to salads to brighten things up. There are some really incredible flavors right now available. Radicchios and chicories are something I really, really love. Those bitter, beautiful purple and pink lettuces. And those pair so nicely with sweet and tart citrus. So that's definitely one of my favorite combinations. But I think all of the root vegetables, things like cauliflower, all of those ingredients are pretty exciting to me.
Well, you queued up one of your recipes we've got at WPR.org/Food Friday. Crunchy citrus with chicories. That's the radicchio you're talking about there. And turmeric tahini dressing. So this is like radicchio and a lot of those chicories, I think, is kind of bitter. You got the tang from the citrus and then the dressing. Tie it all together for us.
Yeah, it's really, I love this one. This is one of the vegan recipes in the book, which is really nice too. I think it's a complete meal without adding additional protein because you've got all of those nuts and seeds on there. And the tahini is another great source of protein that kind of makes it a little more rich and filling. But yeah, this is one of my favorites for sure. And it's really stunning. It's so colorful. And this is one that all of my friends are always very excited to see on the table. It's definitely not boring.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Angie is with us in Madison. Angie, hi.
Hi. So I really like to eat salads with lots of different ingredients. And so the reason why I don't really like to make them at home is because I'll just use a little bit of each ingredient. And then I have a lot left over. So I was wondering if you had any tips on like how to keep those things fresh in the fridge for longer or how to use them up or how to, I don't know, buy smaller quantities or something.
Sure. And Angie, let's name names here. What are some of your most common refrigerator rot ingredients?
Well, of course, the greens go bad really quickly. But I'm thinking like broccoli, I don't know, tomatoes, just anything that's kind of in like a salad.
All right. I gotcha. Angie, thanks a lot. Any advice on making sure Angie can use all those up before they go bad?
I will say that my favorite thing for keeping greens fresh is OXO makes something called a green saver, which sort of looks like a salad spinner, but it's a rectangle that you keep in the fridge. And I don't know how it works, but it will keep your lettuces fresh for an extremely long time. Like I'm talking weeks it can be in there. And it's made of hard plastic, so nothing squishes it in the bins, which I think is also helps keep it fresh for longer. But I also will say it's not helpful right this second, but I am working on my second book, which is all about vegetables. And I know that that is a problem that I have as well. So I'm really trying to figure out recipes that either use the whole thing or utilize leftovers. For tomatoes, I like to throw them into a sauce. If they're feeling like they're really soft and squishy and about to go, I think roasting them for a sauce is a really great thing to do. Just put them in the oven at 450 until they get sort of blistered and brown with a little olive oil, salt and pepper. And you can toss that in on pasta and it's so delicious. I think roasting is always a great method if you have things like broccoli or cauliflower that are getting a little bit soft. And, you know, throwing something that's nice and flavorful on top like chili crisp or a really bright lemony vinaigrette. And you'll be surprised how things are able to bounce back.
Angie, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Kay is with us now in Madison. Kay, hi.
Hi. Well, I have a story about why it's important to wash your greens well. I went out to a restaurant and had a salad, and I found a worm in the salad.
Oh, no.
And I didn't want to kill it. I just put it on the plate next to the salad bowl, and it proceeded to crawl around the bowl. And I started laughing so hard, I thought I was going to get kicked out of the restaurant.
You didn't report it to the restaurant? You just had a new pet, Kay?
Yeah. I did eventually, but that's the reason to wash your greens well.
Kate, thanks. At least you know it's fresh, I guess. Jess, yeah, we want to watch. I mean, it's great to get fresh stuff, but straight out of the garden, we do want to sometimes watch for, I guess, uninvited guests.
Yes, definitely. And that's why that salad spinning technique is, you will not have that problem. It's definitely worth the few extra minutes to always do that before you make a salad.
Thanks for sharing that story. We're talking to food stylist and cookbook author Jess Demick. It's Food Friday. We're talking about her new book. It's called Salad Freak, Recipes to Feed a Healthy Obsession. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a salad freak yourself? Got to have one with every meal, as many meals even? Do you have a recipe or ingredient that you're really liking right now? Or do you have a question for our guest? Need some advice? Call in at 800-642-1234. And in a Wisconsin winter, what do you like to do for your salads? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our Food Friday conversation with Jess Demick. She's the author of the new cookbook, Salad Freaks, a Salad Freak Recipes to Feed a Healthy Obsession. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your salad favorites, your salad questions, 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Go back to your calls now with Jeff in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. I am a big fan of cabbage, and I'd like to hear your thoughts about how versatile the cabbage is. You can do cabbage rolls, you can boil cabbage, you can make kimchi. But I just had a conversation in the grocery store here in Superior at the deli, because in the summertime they make what they call a summer slaw, which is coleslaw, but they add chopped tomatoes and cucumbers, and it's my favorite thing, but they only make it in the summertime. Do you have any other ideas?
Jeff, thanks for the call. And Jeff answers my question of great things to make in a salad in Wisconsin winter. Cabbage really keeps.
I really love cabbage, and I've been developing a lot of cabbage recipes lately, actually. I love raw cabbage. I have a few recipes with raw cabbage in the book. I really like bringing Asian flavors into cabbage, like ginger. And that's one recipe that I have in the book. It's a crispy chicken with gingery cabbage, mandarins, and almonds. So I throw that on top of a crispy chicken cutlet, and it's so delicious and super filling. And I think the cabbage can feel really fresh and light and delicious, even in the middle of winter. I definitely think kimchi is a really fun thing to make. I just made a batch last week, and you know, there's so many ways to use kimchi. It adds so much flavor to different things, and it's great to eat on its own. And I've been experimenting with some krauts as well. They're kind of easy fermentation projects, and it's a really nice way to use cabbage up if you have a little bit of extra. And you can sort of set it and forget it in the back of your fridge for a while and come back and enjoy it later, which is always nice. But I've been doing another raw cabbage salad and just shredding it really thinly on a mandolin and tossing it with cucumbers, some sprouts, and then like a creamy sesame dressing. And that one is so fresh and so delicious. I've really been enjoying that one a lot lately.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jeff, at 800-642-1234. Jess, let's talk about dressings. It's easy to buy salad dressing at the store. Your recipes have dressings that go into them, and honestly, they don't look like they're that hard to make for the most part. Can you talk about what we get out of making our own dressing for these salads?
I think if there's one takeaway from this whole book I've written, I really hope that it's people start making their own dressing. I know it took about 10 years of working in the food industry to convince my parents that it was a good idea to make your own dressings and it wasn't too difficult. And they finally started when this book came out, and, you know, they'll never go back. It really just makes your salad feel so fresh and just full of flavor. And you can really control, you know, the amount of acid, if you need to add a little sweetness, if you have fresh herbs on hand. And it just, I don't know, there's really no going back once you start. And it's just a simple thing you can do that truly takes a couple of minutes that just makes a huge, huge difference.
And another difference maker, now we think of salads, you might think of the produce and the dressing. You're also using some canned and jarred ingredients, beans, some seafood types of things. Can you talk about that as a quick and easy way to add some variety to a salad?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know that fresh ingredients are the biggest thing we think of when we think of salads, but having a well-stocked pantry is super important too, because first of all, having a stocked pantry means vinegars and oils, and then you're going to get a ton of variety in flavor in your dressings. And so you're not going to get sick of them if you have a couple different things on rotation. And then, yeah, I love keeping canned beans and tinned fish on hand, because that's a really quick way to turn a salad into something that you're just eating on the side to a really fulfilling main dish. And it comes together in minutes. Truly like putting a can of a delicious tinned fish on top of a salad, you have like a beautiful meal that's ready in just a couple minutes.
Well, now here's a question for all the way on the other side of the glass here. Our technical director, Trina, asks, how do you make uncooked kale taste good in a salad? Somebody told me to massage it with olive oil and sea salt. All right. Can you help Trina out? How do we make uncooked kale pop in a salad?
Massaging is a very important thing. I like to massage the entire dressing into the kale, actually. And I really prefer kale shredded than in big pieces. It can get kind of tough and difficult to eat when it's like big old chunks. But yeah, you have to give it a little rub. Also, you can just put the dressing on and let it sit for a little bit, which is usually not the case for salads. Usually you want to dress right before you're about to eat because you don't want those leaves to get soggy. But with kale, it's hardy enough to hold up a little bit to the dressing ingredients. So you kind of want it to actually soften a little bit.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Jess Damick. Her new cookbook is called Salad Freak, Recipes to Feed a Healthy Obsession. Find info about the book and some recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. Back to your calls now. Pat is with us in Suamico. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Enjoying this program. And I am a salad freak. A lot of times I will take salad for my lunchtime. I get up earlier because I need to go in early, but it takes time to get my greens, chop up my stuff, and throw them in my little container. And I'll do, a lot of times I get the salad greens that are in the little plastic containers, grab a handful, I wash those out, and I've got a little colander, and I take a hand towel to dampen those out. First, I make sure that I get the water out as best as I can, and then I'll take the hand towel and kind of smash them down a little bit, and then I'll throw in anything from cauliflower to broccoli, depending what I have, carrots, radishes, chop them up, chop up celery, taking canned beets, chopping up canned beets, ooh, throwing those in there, getting those little grape tomatoes. I found some that they were colorful tomatoes, so I throw those in there. If we've got some spare ham, I'll take that, chop that up, throw that on there. I'll throw in some raisins on top of that. If I don't have the ham, I'll take some cheese, chop that up,
nice,
throw that in there. And I've got a complete meal there.
Fantastic. Pat, thanks. Pat is a salad freak, Jess, as well. I mean, she makes me think, like, so she's bringing those into work. Do you have an idea for a salad that, you know, travels well, whether it's in a lunchbox or wherever we're going?
I believe that any salad can travel well as long as you have your dressing on the side. And they make some really great to-go salad containers now that you can find. But also I find just throwing dressing in a mason jar on the side, they seal really tightly. They travel well. It's kind of the perfect amount of dressing. If you make a bigger batch, you can have it for a couple of days. And I think the key is really just assemble it right when you're going to eat it. You can put all of the ingredients together in one thing except for the dressing, because you don't want it to get soggy.
Thanks a lot, Pat. Just our last minute, one of the recipes you shared with us, Jess, is for a breakfast salad. This is the citrus breakfast salad with spicy chili granola. People can look it up at WPR.org/Food Friday. Breakfast salads, though, you're big on those.
I am. I love them so much. Why not get started first thing in the morning? I always feel so much better if I have some fresh fruit or vegetables in the morning. And I think, this is kind of where I push the definition of a salad a little bit. But hey, fruit salads are a thing, to me, there's nothing more delicious than a big plate of beautiful California citrus, a little yogurt, a little granola, super satisfying, super fresh. And I think it's a really great way to start the day.
Jess, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This was so fun.
That's Jess Dammack, food stylist and cookbook author. She joined us today on Food Friday to talk about her new cookbook. It's called Salad Freak, Recipes to Feed a Healthy Obsession. You can find a link to info about the book plus 3 recipes over on our website at WPR.org/Food Friday. Now, I just mentioned that breakfast salad, citrus breakfast salad with spicy chili granola. We talked about the crunchy citrus with chicories and turmeric tahini dressing. Bonus, there's Little Gem, that's a kind of lettuce, Little Gem with creamy dressing, hazelnuts, and petals, like flower petals, edible ones. Find those all at WPR.org/Food Friday. And if you have a favorite salad, some advice you want to share with the world, the greatest salad you ever ate, let us know about it. You can do that at the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can always email us, ideas@WPR.org. Love to hear about your favorite salads. Coming up Monday at noon, join us on Wisconsin Public Radio to celebrate the life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. That's live from the Capitol Rotunda, Wisconsin's 42nd annual tribute and ceremony with words and music. It's the nation's oldest official MLK state commemoration. Tune in Monday at noon. Listen here on Wisconsin Public Radio or online at WPR.org. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. CBS News reported earlier this week that government documents marked classified had been found at the Penn Biden Center, where President Biden had had an office for several years, including after his term as vice president. We've since learned about additional documents that turned up in Biden's private residence in Delaware. Yesterday, Attorney General Merrick Garland announced the Justice Department would be looking into all of it.
I strongly believe that the normal processes of this department can handle all investigations with integrity. But under the regulations, the extraordinary circumstances here require the appointment of a special counsel for this matter. This appointment underscores for the public the department's commitment to both independence and accountability in particularly sensitive matters, and to making decisions indisputably guided only by the facts and the law.
That special counsel will focus on the Biden document story. There's already another special counsel focused in part on former President Trump's removal of classified documents. House Judiciary Committee announced today that it would conduct oversight of this special counsel investigation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about all of this? What is similar? What is different between the investigations into classified documents regarding current President Biden, former President Trump? What's your reaction to all of this? Do you think we need to change the way we handle these documents in the first place? What do you think about the appointment of a special counsel? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. David Schultz is professor of political science at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. He's the author of the book, Politainment, The 10 Rules of Contemporary Politics. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me again. Thank you to the listeners for tuning in.
Can you share your thoughts, first of all, on the appointment of a special counsel by the Attorney General to investigate these documents?
It's probably necessary at this point, given the fact that there's a special counsel who was also appointed to do investigations regarding Donald Trump on a variety of matters. And given the fact that the Attorney General is now being asked to investigate his boss, you really need a process set up to take it away from him and have somebody independent do this. There's a broader discussion probably to have about the fact that post-Watergate, we did have a special prosecutor law in place permanently to address these issues, and it expired in the 1990s. And we may want to have a larger discussion at some point regarding the desirability of bringing such a law back in terms of not having it ad hoc like it is here. But I think given the difficulty of potential, and I say potential violations of the law within the executive branch, an independent counsel is necessary here.
Yeah, the Attorney General is this weird kind of ambiguous position. They're a cabinet appointee of the president, confirmed by the Senate. They're in the chain of command with the president at the top of it, but they're supposed to be independent, too, and able to investigate the current executive branch, among other things. Does that create a natural tension there?
It does create a natural tension. And what also makes it more complicated here is that the person who's the Attorney General, besides reporting to the president, is supposed to represent the United States of America, representing, you know, the government. But at the same time, in some situations, the Attorney General provides, let's say, some legal advice to the president, not the president's personal legal counsel, but provides counsel. And so this creates a series of conflicts of interest and difficulties in terms of sorting them out. So the idea of creating a special counsel is to try to address this issue. One can sort of argue that one of the things that maybe our constitutional framers missed, you know, back in 1787 in drafting the Constitution, is how do we go about policing the executive branch, which is entrusted to enforce the law, if there's allegations that somebody, including the president, has violated the law? This is a problem for us.
Before we get into the particulars of these documents, you mentioned to our producer we should first talk about the Presidential Papers Act. Why is that an important first step?
Okay, so the Presidential Papers Act was adopted, I believe, in 1981. And it's a really simple concept that says that the papers of the President of the United States do not belong to the President of the United States in terms of official government documents. That while the president is president, obviously they produce lots of documents, lots of memos and so forth like that. But when that person leaves office, they do not get to take the government documents with them. They are supposed to be deposited with the National Archives for posterity, for future history. And the reason why I mention this is that across the board, whether we're talking about Donald Trump, whether we're talking about Joe Biden, or take us back to 2016 regarding allegations against Secretary Clinton and emails, at the end of the day, these papers, these communications are supposed to belong to the president, or rather belong to the National Archives, and should not be treated as personal property. So the question becomes, for our purposes with Trump and with Biden, how did these papers get into their personal possession? And then what should we be doing about it? And how have the two of them responded in terms of returning these materials back to the United States and to the archives?
Talking to David Schultz, political scientist at Hamline University, law professor at the University of Minnesota, looking at presidential documents. The news this week that when he left the White House as vice president, Joe Biden ended up with some of these classified documents in an office and at his personal residence. This follows the long-running story of former President Trump taking documents with him. You can join in with your reactions, your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And with these documents in Biden's apparent possession, David, we don't have a ton of details. What do we know that you see as significant?
Well, what we know at this point, it seems to be a small number, although I think a story later today seems to be increasing the number. And what we seem to know in terms of a contrast here is that when Trump left the White House, he took an undisclosed number, although we now think it's about several hundred documents, some of them classified, some of them top secret, to the Mar-a-Lago. They were not safely stored. And then when requested by the Justice Department to return them, there was an initial denial that they had anything. Eventually, the Justice Department had to secure a search warrant to go get these documents. In the case of Joe Biden, right now it seems like it's a more limited number of documents that Biden has discovered and is now turning over and cooperating with the Justice Department. And this seems to be, I think, an important factual difference between the two in terms of how both Trump and Biden are approaching these documents and how they're responding to complying with the presidential papers law.
Now, I mentioned the House Judiciary Committee looking at an investigation into the Biden documents. On the one hand, you might say, okay, yeah, of course, Republicans in the House, they're going to want to go after a Democrat in the White House. On the other hand, this is part of what Congress is supposed to do, right? This is their role to provide oversight over the executive branch.
You're absolutely correct. And there is I think if we cut through some of the partisanship, there is a bigger concern here, is the fact that we now have a former vice president who's now president and a former president who have in possession documents that they're not supposed to have at this point. And I think Congress should legitimately figure out, do we need to change the law? Do we need to strengthen it? You know, what are some different protocols that are in place to make sure that these documents don't slip out? To the best of our knowledge, neither the documents in Biden's possession nor Trump's possession, to the best of our knowledge, have compromised, let's say, national security or anything critical. But that's a legitimate concern for Congress to think about. And just for people, I want to put a perspective in here, is for those people who are listeners who have served in the military, for example, they would know that any classified material, they have to guard very cautiously. And for any of us who've ever worked from home, where we want to, like, you know, access files from home or take files home, most of us know that there's all types of protocols in place to protect a company's secrets. We should think of the same issue here. How does Congress, in its legitimate oversight functions, ensure that we do not compromise national security or confidential information? And that's a legitimate job for this Congress to look at.
Let's bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. Rick is with us in Monona. Rick, hi.
Hi. I'm sorry that this happened to Biden. I don't know if there's something wrong with the system of keeping track of those top secret papers, but the thing I really wanted to talk about is how the Republicans were so quiet during this whole thing with Trump, and Trump was fighting it tooth and nail and not responding, and that they had to go in with the FBI and a search warrant. The Republicans didn't say anything other than the FBI was being weaponized. But now, suddenly, when they find Biden has these papers, they're all over it, with investigations, with assessments, and with the special counsel. I just get kind of annoyed at that, and maybe that's a sign that we really do have a broken government.
Rick, thanks for the call. Just one clarification. I've seen classified, the word used to describe these documents in Biden's possession. I don't know that I've seen top secret yet, David, but to Rick's wider point, the varying partisan response to these two different instances.
I think he's absolutely correct here, is that we are seeing on both sides very different partisan responses. For the Democrats, when it was Trump, it was like, go get him. Again, Republicans seem to be like, you know, this is what? This is just harassing a former president. Now the shoe is on the other foot. And what I'm trying to sort of argue here is the fact that we've got a broader principle at stake here, a broader concern about that we have a law in place that says these documents are to be protected. Former presidents, former vice presidents do not get to leave the job taking these documents with them. We need to figure out, are there better protocols in place, better procedures to make sure that this doesn't happen in the future? Again, It doesn't look like in either situations that national security was compromised, as far as we know, or that secrets got out to the enemy. But there may be things that we need to do to make sure this doesn't happen in the future. And even if we assume for the sake of argument that both Trump and Biden were, let's say, benign, their motives were not harmful, there still appears to be a problem here we need to address.
Rick, thanks for that call. We're talking to David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota, looking at the government documents marked classified that have turned up in an office used by President Joe Biden, as well as Biden's private residence in Delaware, as apparently stemming from his departure from the White House after his term as vice president. Also, comparisons and contrasts with former President Trump and his document story. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have questions about this new special counsel investigation, the one applied to former President Trump as well. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University, of law at the University of Minnesota, looking at the special counsel appointment to look at classified documents in an office used by now President Biden after his term as vice president and at his residence, and comparisons with the Trump classified document investigation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls. John is with us in Lake Halley. John, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. As much as I believe there is a difference between the former president and the current one, both of them have actually broken the law, and both of them disqualified running for office.
John, thanks for the call. Both, he says, broke the law. He was breaking up a little bit there and should be disqualified, John says, from running for office. What do you think?
Well, at this point, it does look like both of them have broken the law. Now, when I say broken the law, we have to, obviously the law, if they did something, it looks like they're wrong. Whether or not they're criminally culpable, that's what the whole purpose of the special investigators or special prosecutors are for. In terms of whether they should be disqualified for running for office in the future, that probably becomes a question for the public to decide at this point. You know, that how do you put this into the mix in terms of thinking about as potential nominees for 2024? I'll pass on answering that question. I think that's the choice of the American public.
John, thanks for that call. Jim joins us now in Dubuque. Jim, hi.
Nothing but season bait.
Oh, you there, Jim? Hello? Yeah, yes. You're on the air, Jim. Go for it.
It's my understanding that anybody who takes secure documents out of the appropriate location is breaking the law, whether they're vice president or president or whatever, except that a president can declassify documents at his will, and there is no legal procedure or proof needed. I haven't seen any evidence that he did not declassify documents that he had. Until we know what the contents of these documents are, we can't know whether they might have been taken because they were incriminating and the person didn't want them available. We need to know what the documents were about.
Jim, thanks for the call. A couple points there. The idea that, yeah, if you were that person in the military you mentioned earlier, David, or a contractor or whatever, you might well face consequences in terms of losing your job or going to jail. Are things different for a president or a vice president?
No, they are not, actually. And there's been a lot of talk out there saying, well, presidents can just on their own just declassify documents. And the answer is not really, is that there is a established procedure that must be followed both to classify documents in terms of classified, secret, top secret, et cetera, like that. But at the same time, if a president wants to, let us say, I'll just make up an example here. We wanted for some reason to make public information regarding, let's say, our nuclear fleet or something like that. A president just can't say, here's the information. There is a set of protocols and rules for declassifying. I know there's at one point Donald Trump made some kind of argument that said he can just sort of, you know, declassify by his mind or something like that. I can't remember what his phrase was. The answer is no. There's Our system has rules in place to how to do this. And presidents, too, would be held accountable or should be held accountable if they release information that's supposed to be classified without following the proper procedures.
Thanks for the call. Josh joins us now in Waukesha. John, hi.
Oh, it'd be Josh in Waukesha.
Oh, Josh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I don't have my glasses on.
So it's my understanding that as president, he has the authority to be in charge of these documents, and also that the FBI was aware that Trump was in possession of these documents, and even just simply told him to put a lock on them, and they had access to them prior to the raid, and he had the right and authority to have those as president. But Biden, as vice president, did not have that same governmental authority over these documents that a president would have. So, and I just have to disagree that the president doesn't have authority over documents that he sees as necessary for him to have access to or decide where and when he is storing those documents. I don't understand how.
Got it. Josh, thanks for calling in. I had thought that too, David, the president-vice president thing, but there was a 2009 Obama-era executive order that does give a vice president the power to declassify documents while they're in office. So, but the fact is, like, it doesn't seem like they went through the process in either case to declassify these.
Correct. Absolutely correct. I think the point is, well, is exactly the point I was trying to make there, is that a president or vice president does have control of the documents, but if they want to declassify, they have to go through a process. But just sort of added up here also, too, is that once they're no longer president, once they're no longer vice president, they have no authority whatsoever to either have these documents in their possession or to try to take any action to declassify it, because what? They're no longer in power. So those are critical things to point out here. Yes, perhaps while Trump was president, maybe it's okay for him to have the documents at Mar-a-Lago where he was working. But clearly, once he's no longer president, he shouldn't have those possession. But this does raise a bigger question, is that If presidents are going to be working somewhere else, and this is my analogy to us working at home, if we're working at home, as far as I know, our companies are going to have protocols for how we protect any trade secrets, how we access files, et cetera, et cetera. We may be thinking about a question of saying, should we allow presidents to be able to move classified documents to non-secure locations such as private residences or vacation places? I think this is part of what the investigations with Congress need to address.
I want to take a minute or so to look at the appointee as special counsel to investigate the documents that had been in Biden's possession. This is Robert Hur. He'd been a Maryland U.S. attorney. He was a Trump appointee to that post and served in the Trump White House. What do you think of the politics and the image of that choice?
I think they had to do something like that. I think it's a good choice, by the way. He's got a clean reputation, as far as I know. And the fact that you're having somebody who was appointed by the previous president, I think should take some of the concern out with some people thinking, well, it's just a Democrat with a Democratic attorney general hiring a Democratic prosecutor. The fact that they're going to give independence to a Trump-appointed person certainly isn't going to assuage all critics, but I think it moves in a good direction.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
My pleasure, and thank you to the listeners.
That's David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. We talked to him today about the developing story of government documents that had been marked classified that were found in an office and then a residence of President Joe Biden, and how the facts of that story compare and contrast with a similar one surrounding former President Donald Trump. Keep watching at WPR.org. We'll keep sharing reporting from NPR as that story develops. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, a recent breakthrough in fusion energy could also give us new insights into what's going on inside of stars. An astrophysicist joins the show to share the mysteries of fusion in our sun and beyond. We'll meet the new Secretary of Wisconsin's Department of Natural Resources for a look at top priorities in the new year, including ongoing concerns about PFAS chemicals in water supplies, plus the possibility of limited medical marijuana laws here in Wisconsin. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time.